Dick Strasser here in the living room of Maestro Stuart Molina, and we're talking in a very busy week about a concert coming up this weekend, which is Saturday the 26th and Sunday the 27th at the Forum in downtown Harrisburg. And this is a program that, I hate to say, that doesn't have a big warhorse type of connection.
It does not.
Or something that you can give a title to easily, but you're featuring a principal player of the orchestra as a soloist. You've got a Beethoven symphony, which is no slouch.
Nope.
And you've got music of Bach to open the program.
Yeah.
And I guess the question, unanswered or otherwise, is what brings all of these things together?
Well, as always, it's music that I love. And I suppose that if you take the Ives unanswered question with which we're opening the second half of the program, I think the answer is so wide-ranging that the only appropriate pairings for that would be a wide-ranging program. And we have Bach, which is music we don't perform very often with the symphony, his third orchestral suite. We have this viola concerto, which I would be very surprised if anyone in the audience has ever heard before, by Lukács.
Or even knew the composer.
Or even knew of the composer or anything like that. And then we have, right after the Ives, Beethoven's Eighth Symphony, which is not as often performed as some of his others, and yet, in its own way, an incredible masterpiece, a piece of, in fact, I think a perfect piece, his most compact symphony, and packed with great music. And so it is a little bit of a hodgepodgey approach to programming, but by the same token, I think these are the kinds of programs that come together very, very beautifully, and I think it will be to great effect.
I know this is one of my favorite Beethoven symphonies, and it's one that I rarely hear live. Actually, it was one of Beethoven's favorite symphonies, too.
Yeah.
He liked it more than the Seventh.
That's right. And I love the Seventh. Well, it's my favorite.
Yeah, the Seventh is probably everybody. Well, the Fifth is probably everybody's most familiar.
Yeah.
But the Seventh is probably everybody's favorite.
Yeah.
And yet, it's like his attitude was, well, they would like the Seventh. You know, it was designed essentially to do that. And he had more to say in the Eighth, I think.
Well, and he was really paying homage both to his early self and to those that came before him. Wow, in a certain sense, really looking forward. I mean, it's kind of a funny bridging the gap kind of piece. There's no real way to characterize it. It's late Beethoven, and yet it doesn't have any of the weirdness of late Beethoven. Mm-hmm. It's just wonderful.
Yeah. One of the things I love about this piece is that when you think about it, it's like everybody says the even-numbered symphonies aren't as good as the odd-numbered symphonies, you know. I don't know what it is, but there is something, you know, 2 and 4 and 8 in particular are never performed as well or liked as much and all that kind of stuff. But yet, if you took away some of the other ones, I think anybody who was writing symphonies at that time would kill good a piece.
And I think that had Beethoven not written the 7th and 9th symphonies, mm-hmm. the 8th symphony would have its rightful place as one of the great symphonies. Mm-hmm. And I think if he had stopped after the 2nd symphony, that would have been the greatest symphony of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's unfair to compare these monumental pieces like the Eroica, like the 5th symphony, like the 7th symphony, and particularly the 9th, to these much more introverted, pastoral kinds of approaches. The Sixth Symphony is a work of utter genius, but it has no bombast to
right.
it. It's like a smile as opposed to, you know, raucous laughter. And so I don't know. I think it's an unfair comparison. I think each of the 9 symphonies is a gem, and to compare them to each other is doing an injustice.
Mm-hmm. The fact that he wrote a lot of these as pairs, I mean, the 4th and 5th were written yep. almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Actually, the 7th and 8th were also, from what I remember, they're mixed up in the sketchbooks. And a lot of the ideas that eventually became things that he used in the 9th were mixed in with that, and then he put them aside to use later, and then he was also working on a 10th, which, of course, we'll never know what it was like.
Unfortunately.
But each of these pairs, as often happens with him, in terms of the string quartets also, was that they have very different personalities. They were designed to be different.
That's right. And actually, I think the 7th and 8th have a lot more in common mm-hmm. than the 4th and the 5th, let's say.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, horses of a different color by the same token. So the 8th, by any standard, is a great work. The fact that it's only 25 minutes long or so makes it hard to program.
Mm-hmm.
because it isn't quite enough to be an entire second half of the program, and it's too much to open a concert. And so I like what we've done, having the unanswered question as this kind of hovering, atmospheric, very strange piece, followed by this great work.
Well, the idea of the trumpet, which is always asking the question over and over again, is kind of, I guess, like maybe Beethoven pronouncing his aesthetic view or something like this, and then the critics are the woodwinds.
Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe.
It might work in that way. And, sure. And of course, the strings in the Ives are this kind of old chord progression, harmonic,
absolutely
standard, old procedure
yeah.
kind of background.
Yeah. To music of the spheres happening way back. He actually wanted the piece where the strings were off stage,
mm-hmm.
and you could barely hear them, and then having the woodwind choir and the trumpet placed in various places. We will have the strings on stage. We don't really have a good space off stage to have the strings off stage, but I will have, hopefully, I mean, we'll see how it actually plays out, but have the trumpet and the woodwind choir in various places within the hall and have this strange, because he doesn't care if it's together.
Mm-hmm.
He wants the woodwinds to play together. Yeah. He wants the trumpet to have kind of its own independence, and then
the strings
play without change, just mm-hmm. triple piano from beginning to end. So it'll be fun. It'll be fun mm-hmm. to see.
I remember doing this with Larry Newland back in the 80s,
uh-huh.
That we had, the strings were in the promenade, and it was very difficult because we had to set up all the stands and
sure.
you know, the light.
Well, there you get into just practical issues that it just doesn't make sense. The audience doesn't want to sit for 10 minutes while things are set up. And I don't think you really lose anything by having the woodwinds in the hall and the strings on the stage.
Yeah.
But I understand his idea, and it actually fits in better with what Ives indicates.
Excuse me. Now, with Ives and Beethoven on the second half, you said orchestras don't normally program Bach.
Well, right? We don't.
I think any orchestra.
The orchestras these days perform mostly from Beethoven through Shostakovich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you'll have a smattering of modern music and a smattering of classical music. But Baroque music, except for special effects like special events like the Messiah or things of that ilk, just doesn't get performed much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we're doing it. I think it'll be fantastic. And it is an undeniably great work, this third orchestral suite, and very familiar. And I think it will showcase the skills of our players. But It's just one of these strange facts that we don't do a lot of Bach.
And there's a lot of interweaving skills that ensembles have to figure out when they're playing Bach.
Absolutely. It's hard music.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons that I hesitate to do Bach is that I find it very difficult. It's you want it to be perfect, and you want every phrase to be perfectly shaped, and There are time constraints that make that difficult, and because the players in the orchestra mostly play more contemporary music, and meaning within
more
300 years, they also it takes an adjustment to get into that world of playing Baroque music. So that will also be, I think, a terrific experience for us, and hopefully a wonderful performance.
I know a lot of touring orchestras that specialize the early music ensembles.
Sure.
Are the ones that are now brought in as guests so that an audience can get a quota of some Baroque music or something as appropriately played or whatever. So they say. Yeah, and I know, I mean, when I was growing up, we always heard Bach and Handel, the Water Music Suite, which was done with this Englishman's huge orchestration and everything, a full 90-piece orchestra playing it, and you lose a lot of that texture.
It makes no sense. It's all about counterpoint, and if you have that many players, you lose the counterpoint. It just gets too muddy.
Are you using a reduced orchestra?
Yes, we are. For the entire program, we're using reduced orchestra, because the Beethoven is very much a chamber orchestra approach to symphonic writing. The Ives, he wrote it originally for a string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
We won't be using a string quartet, but it will be a small string orchestra. And the Lukács also is a chamber orchestra work. So it will be not a teensy orchestra, but a similar size orchestra to what we used, let's say, for Haydn's Creation and Mozart Requiem.
Okay. Well, that leaves the Viola Concerto for last that we've talked about. And I guess the first thing I'm thinking about this is, where did this come from? Where did this piece come from?
The story is a very simple one. I wanted to feature Julius Wirth, our principal violist, as soloist.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me a number of concertos to listen to, and none of them I liked all that much. I mean, he wanted to play the Bartok, and it's not my favorite piece. And he gave me the Martinu, which I liked very much until the end, and it has a very unsatisfying ending. He gave me the Britten Double Concerto as a possibility to play with Odin. There, too, I thought that the piece was terrific, and then in the last movement kind of died. And so I just wasn't turned on by any of these ideas. Yeah. I had a couple of pieces in mind that he didn't want to play because he felt that they required a much bigger sound than he was able to produce. So I went to iTunes, and I just put in Viola Concerto, see what would come up, what concertos haven't I heard. And this recording came up of Lukasz, and I'd never heard of Lukasz, so I went to his site, and he's a recently deceased Czech composer, and I really liked the piece. I thought that it was fantastic, in fact. So I got the music, the recording, to Julius to listen to, and he too liked the piece very much. And so we decided we would do it. For better or for worse, that wasn't the end of it, because you then have to find the music. And so we had negotiations with Lukasz's family and the publishers, and it was rather an ordeal for our librarian. But eventually we found it and got it, and the more I spend time with it, the more I like it. I think it's a piece that has a deserved spot in the viola repertoire, and I'm very glad that we're presenting it. I don't know whether it's ever been played in the United States before. Mm-hmm. There's no history of performance as far as I know. And so this is cool, and I think Julius is really excited to be doing, you know, it feels like a world premiere, even though it has been performed and recorded. Mm-hmm. And there's always an excitement about performing a piece that no one in the audience will have heard before. You know, there's that discovery, and there are moments of, I think, real beauty. It has moments of great rhythmic energy, of sorrow. And it's quirky in the way it's orchestrated and put together. It doesn't have a timpani, but rather it has pitched tom-toms that accompany the piece. And the viola part at certain points is playing kind of a perpetual motion figure within this rather quintessential Eastern European scale, with half steps and whole steps. I think the orchestra is going to have a lot of fun. I think Julius is already having a lot of fun with it. And I hope the audience likes it as much as we do. I mean, that's always the hope. When you perform a piece that's not, you know, standard repertoire, there's always the question mark. You know, how is it going to go over? When we did the Rocha variations and finale, you know, I knew I liked it very much. I knew I thought that it was great. But you still don't know how it's going to go over with an audience until you actually do it. And this one, it's the same thing. I think that his musical language is one that the audience will immediately grasp onto. Mm-hmm. Like the Beethoven, is a looking back at those that came before him, and you hear elements of, you know, composers ranging from Bartok to Karl Orff to Kodály to even the earlier Eastern European folk music writers, and I think it's a very heartfelt and beautiful piece.
I know a lot of people are reluctant to take on a piece that A, they haven't heard before, and B, are not familiar with the composer at all, to have some kind of, well, like, what does it sound like, you know, kind of thing. So,
well, there was this recording, so we did have some kind of framework for what it sounds like. The more I listen to the recording, the less I like it, and that always happens. Because, you know,
The recording,
yeah. No, the piece, I think, is terrific. But the more I like the piece, the more I find my own way that I want to do it. And if it doesn't match the recording, as it rarely does.
Right.
It was a piece also that I, you know, most of it I can play at the piano. So I, you know, it was a good piece to do as a premiere of sorts, because didn't need that. You know, if it were a very atonal, very difficult piece to hear in my head, then there are real challenges. But Julius loves taking on new stuff. He writes music himself. He's very into presenting new music, and he wants to spread the gospel of the Lukasz Concerto.
Well, there's a lot of viola concertos out there that could use that kind of of PR, too.
Sure.
So well, that's great. So we've got Bach, and then the Lukasz on the first half, Ives Unanswered Question, which is actually something that dates from, what, 1906 or something like
that? Yeah, early in the 20th century.
And then Beethoven's Eighth, which is both looking back as well as one of the great symphonies of its day.
So there are definitely... it is a great program, and there are definitely through lines that are abstract, but I don't think that it's going to feel like, ooh, a jolt. From one piece to the next, it does feel... I think it will flow nicely.
Well, you go through generations. I mean, you know, from the early 18th to the early 19th to the early 20th and to, what, 1983, I think, was when the viola concerto was composed.
Yeah, and if you think of the unanswered question as whence music, you know, that Bernstein says that's the question, wherefore music? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer is any one of these pieces.
Blowing the wind.
It is a question that the very first moment of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony will dispel any doubt that music is just music and worthy of great celebration.
So come and celebrate with us. We have our concerts Saturday at 8 o'clock and Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Forum in downtown Harrisburg.
We have pre-concert lectures at 7 and at 2, and we have post-concert questions and answers afterwards. So join us for any or all.
And next month we'll be back to talk about Mahler.
Oh, my God. Give me strength.
Just around the corner.
Thank you, Dick.